today. Why is stop and search, which has been described as ineffective and racist, on the rise?
I remember the first time I was stopped and searched, I was 11. And I remember going back home and telling my mum that I got stopped and searched, and her looking at me like really confused. But I don't know, I thought it was normal. I remember what I was wearing and everything.
What were you wearing?
It was like 2005, and like stripy hoodies were in fashion. I had like a stripy hoodie.
Stripy hoodies were never in fashion, were they?
Yeah.
Did you have anything on you?
No, I never had anything on me.
They just stop a 11-year-old walking up the road?
Yeah, I was by myself as well.
So from that moment, you must have been wary of the police.
Well, subconsciously, but everything I had done in my life was to not get that kind of attention again, basically. Yeah. Yeah.
This is Jamal. He's now 24 years old. In the 13 years since that first incident, he's been stopped and searched about 10 times. This week, The Guardian revealed that after years of decline, there has been a sharp rise in the use of stop and search by England's biggest police forces. The numbers have more than doubled. The biggest increase was in London. The mayor, Sadiq Khan, insists that it works.
And targeted intelligence-led stop and search is a valuable tool.
And Boris Johnson, likely to be the next Prime Minister, wants to increase the powers further.
I can tell you, after 2 terms, 8 years, at the end of my time as mayor, we got crime down by about 20%, we got the murder rate down by 50%.
And by backing the police and giving them the power to do stop and search.
Yes.
And supporting them when they did that.
But experts say it doesn't reduce crime, and black men like Jamal are 8 or 9 times more likely to be targeted. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, if stop and search doesn't work, why is it on the rise? Before we start this episode, I want to warn you that it does contain swearing and some distressing scenes.
I just came back from work, and after recapping my week with my mum, I left my house. I was going to visit my dad in South London. But it was raining heavily on the evening, so I was standing under shelter waiting for the rain to stop.
Just standing there?
Just standing there.
And what happened?
There were some other young people there. So the officers had come. They were walking up the pathway. I just stepped out of their way. And as I stepped out of their way, one of them said, "Police."
The officers tell the group they're going to carry out a search for weapons under Section 1. Two of them are in plain clothes, one in a hoodie.
So the officers had come and basically alleged that someone had been attacked. One of the young people that were with the separate group had been attacked. One of them grabbed my hand. I didn't understand the reasoning behind it because the officer didn't actually communicate his grounds and how it involved me. Specifically, I went on to tell the officer that I hadn't attacked anyone and I was waiting for the rain to stop, but it was all ignored.
And there's video of it.
Oh, you want to see the video?
How often do you watch it?
Probably if I never had this, I wouldn't know what happened. I'm waiting for the rain to stop. He just grabbed my wrist and he tried to handcuff me, basically. And when I stepped backwards,
and so what did he do?
They just started attacking me, basically. One of them grabbed me in a headlock and the other one grabbed me in a headlock as well. I was asking them what they was doing because this was all within about 15 seconds. And basically they just continued basically shouting and screaming instructions all without presenting an ID.
On the floor now!
Hey, are you on the
Right, I got cuffs.
I mean, the officer hit you with handcuffs. He admitted that in court.
He hit me while I was being held by his colleague with a handcuff across my face.
So we've just watched a video taken from the body cam of a police officer in which the story that you have just told me is exactly what we see. They said that someone had been assaulted and you said, it's nothing to do with me, I live there, and they basically body slammed into the floor.
This is my son, he lives here.
The next thing I remember was my mum coming up.
Take him off the floor.
And she was asking, what's going on?
He's fighting, as you can see.
And they were just basically pushing my mum and just stopping her from being able to calm me down.
Can I just speak to him to get him to calm down, please?
Not right now. You can speak
to him. Yeah, but look, he's distressed. I want to speak to him. He's distressed.
Jamal's mum was particularly concerned because her son has been diagnosed with special educational needs. Later, I watched all three videos from the police body cams showing what happened to Jamal. It's not possible to see every angle or to be certain what happened. But whatever triggered that angry and violent response from the police seemed no more than a slight hand movement. In less than a minute, multiple officers were involved. There was a taser pointed at Jamal's chest and he was being pinned to the ground. He sounded panicked and scared, passively resisting the officers, but not attacking them. Nothing was found on him. Later, Jamal was convicted of assault. An officer claimed that he had tried to strangle him. The videos are chaotic, but I couldn't see that.
Initially, when I stepped away from the officer, that is the first sign of fight or flight. I felt under threat. It was the opposite action of what was described in the statements and throughout court that I had lunged at the officer. It was the opposite. With being SEN, sometimes that things might have to be repeated to me or demonstrated or done correctly. So when thinking about stop and search and knowing the go wisely prefix, there's a sequential way in my mind that the prefix is supposed to be followed.
I'd never heard of go wisely, but many young black men like Jamal know exactly what it is. It's an acronym that's meant to remind police officers of what they need to provide when they stop and search someone. It stands for grounds for the search, the object that they are searching for, a warrant, their identification, the station that the officer is attached to, the person's entitlement to copies of the paperwork, the legal power giving the right to stop and search, and you informing the person why this is happening.
The officer missed out everything in relation to my safety, so I doubted the legitimacy of what he was doing.
When Jamal's case was heard in front of a magistrate, the officers all gave the same story, that he felt wasn't true. But he couldn't persuade the other young people who were there to testify.
I couldn't get them to come into court to basically dispel the officer's allegations of an attack.
Because people are nervous of the system?
Yeah, I think it's pressure from the system. People don't feel like that there's any good outcome when you challenge the police.
When those young kids are watching you getting pinned down by police outside your home, where you were just standing minding your own business, do you think that changes their perception of the police?
No, I think that that's normal to them. They were more receptive to it than I was. And I don't know whether it's obviously my disability, but I had just never been approached like that by any police in my lifetime. So it was very unfamiliar. And without the appearance of a warrant card, it was too much information to process at a time. And I've been at researching into my disorder more, and I felt like I had a meltdown in that situation and it wasn't noticed by the officers. Everything that was supposed to be done to ensure my safety was not done.
Jamal challenged the conviction for assault. It was upheld and he is now appealing that decision. His experience comes at a time that there is a heavy focus on stop and search because of a sense of panic around violent crime in Britain's cities. But this is a police tool that has been used not just for decades, but centuries. Adam Elliott Cooper is an academic at King's College London.
So we can probably trace stop and search back to 1824, the Vagrancy Act.
What, back in 1824 they were stopping and searching people?
Habitual criminals. So they might be sex workers or selling contraband or involved in petty crime and those types of things. But by the time we get to the Victorian times, we actually see the Vagrancy Act being repealed because it violated the old maxim of English law that a man should be considered innocent until proven guilty. But I think what's interesting is that at this time, of course, the British mainland wasn't the only place where Britain were governing. Parts of the Indian subcontinent, the Caribbean, Australia, parts of Africa. And in those parts of Britain's colonies, we didn't see the Vagrancy Act being repealed. We actually saw similar kinds of powers being expanded. And the idea was that these colonised people were more criminal, more deviant, less moral, and therefore required a different kind of justice system, a different kind of policing. And so I think what's important here is that stop and search has been racist for centuries. So after World War II, we begin to see large numbers of people from the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent in particular begin to migrate to Britain to help to rebuild Britain.
Already their coming has caused a national controversy. Whatever our feelings, we cannot deny them entry. For all are British citizens and as such are entitled to the identical rights of any member of the Empire.
By the time we get to the 1970s, we see people from those countries, whose parents are from those countries, being born here. And it's that at that moment that we begin to see the Vagrancy Act being reintroduced and it being referred to as the sus laws, the laws of suspicion.
Wow, so there's really no argument that could take it away from race here. They stopped it on white people, they did it in the colonies, and then when people from the colonies came here, they decided it was good enough again.
That's exactly true. And in many ways, the British police, particularly the Metropolitan Police at that time, were very overt. Kenneth Newman, the head of the Metropolitan Police in the 1980s, said these new immigrants groups are not inculcated with the same kind of law-abiding values as British citizens.
By the 1970s, 1980s, we had these sus laws, sus being a suspected person. What did that mean for people in ethnic minority communities?
So what it effectively meant was, these sus laws, that police officers could use their own suspicion, their own gumption, to decide whether a person should be stopped and searched or not. And so at the time there was this, what we might call a moral panic around mugging. Before the 1970s, the word mugging doesn't exist. It's actually a term borrowed from the United States. And so what politicians and the police were able to do was take lots of different crimes and put them all into this new category of crime and then create the impression that we're having this new crime wave. It's something that's come to Britain from abroad, particularly come to Britain from the Caribbean. I think what happened with the sus laws is they really came to a head in 1981 through an operation called Operation Swamp, where the Metropolitan Police decided to swamp certain parts of London, particularly Brixton in South London, which had one of London's largest Caribbean communities.
They don't see him as an 11-year-old child, right? They see him as a black child with locks. Right? So they will pick him up.
It was very, very difficult to walk around Brixton as a young black man during Operation Swamp without being stopped and searched.
As Operation Swamp ramped up, tensions were heightened. And in early April 1981, rioting began in Brixton.
Nah, it wasn't a race riot. It was a riot against the police and their system and the way they do things. Because it's like you have a dog, right? And every day you kick this dog. Right, one day the dog is going to retaliate and bite you.
And we see that kind of unrest spread to other parts of London and other parts of the country as well.
After the riots, did society sit up and say, we were wrong? And were there actual concrete changes that would change the rules on stop and search?
So we actually see the sus laws repealed.
The fact that you are young, black, or you're dressed in a particular way, or you have a certain hairstyle, is not a good enough reason to stop you.
So the police have to produce forms of evidence if they want to, not necessarily stop and question an individual, but certainly if they want to apprehend and arrest them.
Stabbed by a group of white thugs in an unprovoked racist attack.
If you fast forward into the 90s, we see the murder of Stephen Lawrence. And in the wake of that, we get the McPherson Report. That's published in 1999, 15 years after the sus laws were basically repealed. And it reported that the police was institutionally racist. That's pretty horrifying, given that there should have been a wake-up call so much earlier.
I think that what happened in 1999 was really important, because what it did was it linked the kind of street racism that's led to the killing of Stephen Lawrence with the kind of state racism which led to the murder of Stephen Lawrence not being investigated. And it links that to the other ways in which black communities were, I think, over-policed as citizens but under-policed as victims. But we don't see concrete legislation being introduced.
Was there action in the noughties?
What 9/11 and 7/7 gave the police an opportunity to do was demand for those powers of the 1980s to be reintroduced. And what Tony Blair allowed the police to do was to not only have the powers to stop and search without reasonable suspicion, but also have the powers to use ethnicity as a form of suspicion. Rather than the British courts finding that this is in violation of human rights, the European Court of Human Rights finds that, and we see that power being repealed in 2010.
So basically, they've been told by the European Court of Human Rights, you can't do this. And they say, well, actually, we can, and we're just going to use another method.
Precisely. I guess the only difference being is Section 60 isn't explicitly saying they're allowed to use ethnicity as a reason to stop and search someone.
Section 60 allows police to stop and search within a particular area without reasonable suspicion. Previously, it had often been used when trouble was expected at a football match. But suddenly, it began being applied in new ways.
For instance, we saw an operation called Operation Blunt 2 being used between 2008 and 2011 in London, where the Metropolitan Police applied a massive Section 60 over the whole of the capital. I think what's important is that there appeared to be no evidence whatsoever that increasing levels of stop and search reduced knife crime at all. That initiative ends in May of 2011, and in August of 2011, we have riots.
The latest violence began this afternoon in Hackney in East London, when police were attacked with rocks and missiles. And this was the scene in Birmingham tonight as the violence spread outside the capital for the first time since the trouble erupted on Saturday.
Of course, the killing of Mark Duggan was the spark to those riots, but many of the young people who participated in the unrest did talk about the stop and search leading to those kind of community police breakdowns, which led to them wanting to participate in the unrest.
So it's pretty clear that the riots were linked to anger and frustration with the police. Did the government take action?
So after the riots of 2011, David Cameron declared an all-out war on gangs and gang culture. And he said that gangs were the reason we had this unrest.
It is a major criminal disease that has infected streets and estates across our country.
And so what he began to do was databases such as the Gangs Matrix in London and other parts of Britain, such as Manchester. It's a database of people that the police have identified as being involved in a gang.
What defines a gang?
That's a really good question. So a number of academics actually asked the police that, and they said that it was young people they identified as being involved in serious youth violence. And so what they did was they asked for every single young person identified as being involved in serious youth violence and have that broken down by ethnicity. And then they also asked for all the young people that are identified as being involved in a gang and had that broken down by ethnicity. And what they found that in both London and in Manchester was that the majority of young people being involved in serious youth violence in Manchester were white, but the majority of people identified as being involved in a gang in Manchester were black or Asian. And in London, they found that it was roughly 50-50. So 50% of the people involved in serious youth violence were white, 50% were black or Asian. But the overall majority of people identified as being involved in a gang were black or Asian.
So the response to the riots wasn't to rein in stop and search, it was to go really hard after the same people in another way.
It is violating people's civil liberties in a way that we haven't really seen in this country ever. I think there's such little accountability for the police. I remember once challenging a police officer during a stop and search, and I remember he said to me, "You just spat when you spoke." I was like, "What?" He's like, "You just spat when you spoke. You just spat. Say anything else again and I'll arrest you for common assault."
And had you ever been stopped and searched before?
Yeah, I'd been stopped and searched before as a teenager.
How many times?
I can't remember.
You can't remember because it's quite a few times.
Yeah, I'd say it's quite a few times, yeah.
Have you ever been stopped and searched?
I have not.
So the reason I'm asking you that is that we've had another academic on this episode, Adam, who's black. And as soon as I asked him, he'd been stopped several times.
So not all statistics lie. That is precisely what the statistics would tell you, that the chances of a white, middle-aged, middle-class academic being stopped and searched by the police are pretty minimal.
Mike Shiner is an academic at LSE who has spent years researching Stop and Search. Last year, he was the lead author in a major report, The Colour of Injustice, that looked at the disproportionate targeting of black people through Stop and Search.
We know that after the 2011 riots, David Cameron's response was to say, we have to go after gangs. Was that how his Home Secretary, Theresa May, felt at the time as well?
So Theresa May's position, I think it's fair to say, changed quite dramatically. So initially, her response was quite a traditional law and order one. But along the way, she shifted, and certainly in relation to Stop and Search.
Now, I strongly believe that Stop and Search should be used proportionately, without prejudice, and with the support of local communities.
The general picture across the piece is that Stop and Search has very little, if any, measurable impact on crime, particularly violent crime, serious violent crime. So we've seen since 2010-11 a 76% reduction in the use of Stop and Search. The strength of the grounds has increased dramatically. We've seen a doubling in the arrest rate, all of which points towards a much more careful and considered use of the powers. The one metric that hasn't shifted and actually has gone the wrong way is disproportionality. So the degree to which black people have stopped search compared to whites has increased.
There's been this massive reduction in Stop and Search. It hasn't had any effect on crime figures. There's no particular evidence about the efficacy of Stop and Search. And yet, The Guardian has this week revealed that in 2018, eight major forces recorded over 200,000 stop and searches, a 20% rise on 2017. The Met Police, Greater Manchester and West Midlands were behind the surge. And we're looking at an even bigger spike in 2019. The number of searches in March this year was almost double that of the same month 2 years ago. Is there definitely an increase? And if so, what's behind it?
So the latest figures we have released by government don't show an increase, but the mood music has certainly changed and the language has certainly changed, and our expectation is absolutely that we are in the midst of a pretty sharp increase. And again, it's quite difficult to tell in relation to serious violence because people very often rely on the police figures and the police figures are unreliable. So the best indicator we have, the most reliable one, is homicide. And I think it's pretty clear that homicide is on the up.
The number of people murdered in England and Wales has risen to its highest level for a decade. That's according to the...
Politicians and police feel the need to be doing something, and Stop and Search allows them to demonstrate that they are doing something. Unfortunately, all the evidence we have is it's not terribly effective.
So it sounds like Stop and Search is not about reducing crime. What is it about then?
It's about PR, it's about politics, it's about how organisations feel about themselves. I think it's probably fair to say that we're in a populist moment right now. So it appeals to the national mood, I think.
When people are stopped, what are they finding? And who are they finding it on?
The vast majority of Stop and Search, around 60% nationally, is for drugs. Most of that is for low-level drug possession, particularly cannabis. The amount of Stop and Search that has been for knives has generally been low, hovering between kind of 10 and 13%. So by and large, I mean, one of the reasons why Stop and Search doesn't have a measurable impact on knife crime and serious violence is because that's not generally what police are looking for. The find rate is actually, again, for drugs, is higher for white people than it is for black people. And that's concerning because it indicates that black people might be being stopped and searched on the basis of weaker grounds.
What do you feel now when you see police around?
I actually got stopped on leaving my road again, actually, by uniformed police officers this time, who said that I was speaking to a suspected drug dealer or something, and that I looked very nervous when they saw me. And I agreed with them. I said, yeah, I am very nervous. I was attacked by one of your mates probably just a couple of weeks ago, and told them that I was on my way to my solicitor. I was immediately handcuffed again. I was still feeling the nerves and I was stuttering a lot and I couldn't really articulate myself properly. But as time's progressed, I've done like CBT to get back control of my emotions.
Cognitive behavioural therapy.
Yeah.
And if you were in trouble now, would you call the police? Do you trust the police?
Not with my safety. Not with my safety. I haven't been able to get off my mind. I'm suffering from anxiety, depression. I don't like to accept those things, but it's things that have happened as a result of this event.
how often do you think about this incident?
Every day.
All day, every day?
It's improved.
I've asked you everything I want to, Jamal. Is there anything else you want to add?
I've got some spoken word. I embrace my brother while I'm selling drugs is something socially explicit. We're amongst ourselves but seen as gangs and the police want to come and visit. I'm stuck in a pivot, the gangs of the system. Stop and search ain't the answer. Instead, get me embellished in something to follow up after. I'm stressed and bewildered, my thoughts can't be filtered. I'm talking to masses, I hope I'm received well. I want you to notice the slightest of details. One thing you should know, this was part of my plan. To educate man or not part of a gang. The attack, it was brutal but gave me exposure. Won't react like a rebel, I'm wiser and older. How could you judge all this weight on my shoulders and claim that you came for a lawful proposal? I do not act here, I am antisocial, not by intention but by dysregulation. Special educational needs was a part of my placement. I was left and neglected and never accepted. Fast money was tempting but I picked progression. Mindfulness, how to beat a recession, how to not be a victim of misrepresentation and not being handcuffed and taken to stations. One thing I'm saying, our reality's changing. I hope I inspired the hundreds of masses and all get together and all start to pattern. I took every insult and always stayed humble just to make sure I avoided the trouble. All I got was handcuffs, not knuckles. I was clearly distressed. How can you say you was under duress? I'm angry, quite frankly. Instead of embrace me, you tried to harass and chastise me. One thing I hate is an officer that's grimy. Where is the card you're supposed to provide me? I grew up in the 90s. I ain't part of no urban society. I'm shunned and neglected. Adversity brings out my best bits. I just needed the leverage. Approached unlawfully, now you made me relentless. Good thing I'm seeking justice, not vengeance. Please don't speak about intervention and prevention when police and their bias leads to wrongful detentions. It's out of the question that they're here for protection. I think that they're here for a message that's received but not intercepted. I'm alive in the world and I'm counting my blessings.
I want to thank Jamal. We've changed his name for this programme. And also Adam Elliott Cooper and Mike Shiner. I also want to thank Stopwatch for their help with this programme and also the Runnymede Trust. We went to the Met Police and they said that last year the use of this tactic led to 4,200 weapons and a significant amount of drugs being taken off our streets. In a statement they added, "Tragically in the capital, knife crime and street violence disproportionately affects boys and young men, particularly of African Caribbean heritage, both as victims and perpetrators. As with all types of crime, we must focus our efforts lawfully, ethically and proportionately to stop more young people being injured, dying or damaging their lives by committing serious offences. We acknowledge that historically stop and search has caused concern in some communities. Internal scrutiny and due diligence is provided by monthly meetings focusing on performance and standards. There are also independent stop and search monitoring groups in every borough in London, and we work closely with groups such as the Met's Independent Advisory Group, who provide an external view on our tactics and how we use them. Earlier this week, The Guardian's Sarah Marsh and Patrick Greenfield published the results of a series of Freedom of Information requests to major police forces in England. Have a look at their story on The Guardian website. We'll be talking about the accountability of the police again on Monday. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Chika Ayres and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back on Monday.